Carl has the microphone, so if you'd raise your hand, and I'll let Larry take over as far as questions are concerned, and hold the microphone horizontally, and make your questions short. How'd I do? All right. So. Yes, sir. And the lavender?
This business about ending the drug war, presumably legalizing drugs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
This way?
The business about the drug war, presumably legalizing drugs. That's all fine with me, but there is one little proviso. Back in the days when drugs were legal, and the few people that took them ended up in the gutter, so the moms could walk by and say to their kids, look, here's the guy, this is what happens when you take heroin. Nowadays, we give them counseling, therapy, free apartments. There's a reward for it. Well, if you don't cut back the social programs to reward it, if you don't de-glorify it, and you legalize it, then every pusher is going to be out there in front of the schools giving it to little kids, right?
Because that's business. No, I don't see that at all.
The price is going to fall, and it's going to be... I'm not saying we shouldn't legalize it, but what I'm saying is I think legalizing it has got to be tied to getting rid of all these programs that make it such a lovely thing to become a drug addict.
Well, I don't believe that people who are drug addicts because of programs. I think people are drug addicts for all sorts of reasons. Look, if we legalize drugs, the black market goes away. The analogy to prohibition is right on the money. We outlawed alcohol. And by the way, at least the people who were prohibitionists for alcohol did it with constitutional integrity. They amended the Constitution. We have not amended the Constitution for this war on drugs. It is, to me, an unconstitutional war being fought at the federal level. But the price would go down dramatically. The people that are pushing right now will have to find something else to do. The price would probably be no more expensive than a carton of cigarettes. And I don't know people who are bootlegging cigarettes other than to steal them because of the high taxes. If your argument is that if we tax it to the point where there's still a black market, I'm with you. So therefore, we shouldn't tax it to the point where there's a black market. But the price is going to go down. You will now not have the temptation of young people dropping out of school to earn a fast, silly life selling drugs. Janet Reno estimates that around 50% of all street crime is directly or indirectly related to people robbing and maiming and stealing in order to support their habit. William F. Buckley years ago estimated that when you look at higher insurance costs, lost time from work, property being stolen, the amount of money that people are paying in excess of what they would pay if it were a fair market, we're probably spending about $300 or $400 billion fighting this so-called war on drugs. So for all those reasons, we ought to call it off. Will there be more people using drugs if the drugs are legal? Nobody really knows. My suspicion is not. When you look at young people and you poll them and ask them, why don't you do drugs, at the bottom of the list is they're illegal. At the top of the list is they're stupid. My mom wouldn't like it. My dad wouldn't like it. I wouldn't like it. My friends don't do it. So I don't believe there's going to be a wholesale rush for people to do drugs. But if that is true, it's the price of the ticket. It's still my body. Why is it okay for the guy next door to come home and have a highball, but the guy next to him goes to jail if he has a joint? There's a problem here.
The guy that has a highball is being killed by Johnson, whereas the guy who ran that station from him or heroin or whatever the attack, he's on the nuts, they are back for him.
Right? Yes, sir. Why don't you do this one? Okay. Are you available?
Larry, you give a great speech. Have you ever thought of running for public office?
Walter Cronkite once said, "I'd love to be elected. I hate to have to run." You know, I was first asked that when I first came on the air, and I just thought it was the most outrageous thing I'd ever heard. I mean, these views, legalizing drugs, ending the IRS, privatizing Social Security, getting the government out of health care, I just felt that they were way too radical for people to accept. Now that we've been on the air for about 8 years, 5 years in afternoon drive time in Los Angeles, I can now do an hour where I talk about the privatization of welfare, and I don't get batter the way I did about 5 years ago. So I think, at least in Southern California anyway, more and more people are amenable to my ideas. I have been approached by some people fairly recently to consider a run for governor. The Democrats wouldn't have me. Republicans wouldn't have me. Who does that leave? Sir, over here.
Larry, please wait for the microphone over here.
All right. May I speak? Okay. Is there? Oh, fine. Thank you. Larry, do we have a bona fide black spokesman today? I mean, in the 60s, there was Martin Luther King and, of course, Adam Clayton Powell in the 40s. Is there really an authentic bona fide black spokesman?
Is there an authentic bona fide white spokesman? A man once came into my father's cafe, and he said, a white man, and he said, "Did you hear what your leader said the other night?" And my dad said, "My leader? Who are you talking about?" He said, "Jesse Jackson." He said, "Wait. Who's your leader?" And the guy goes, "Well, I don't have one." And my father said, "What makes you think I have one?" There is no black leader today, nor should there be. The situation is dramatically different from the situation that Martin Luther King Jr. faced. There was a recent article in the LA Times criticizing Martin Luther King III for lacking his father's vision and drive. Well, the circumstances are altogether different. I feel that if there was a law against leadership malpractice, some of the so-called black leaders would be on death row. When you have someone like Minister Farrakhan, who's made the most horrific remarks about Judaism and Jews, when you have somebody like Al Sharpton, who once called Jews diamond merchants and whites interlopers, when you have someone like Julian Bond, who says that his number one agenda is to go after the new racists, when you have the Black Congressional Caucus opposing vouchers, which the majority of black inner city parents want, we got a problem here. 70% of today's black children are born outside of wedlock. 50% of those in prison are black. 25% of young black men have records. And as I mentioned earlier, inner city black kids, the majority of them cannot read and write at grade level. And Julian Bond says his number one priority will be to go after the new races. I mean, there's something very disturbing about that. So not only do we not have a black leader, nor should we have a black leader given the complexity of the situation and given how successful the black middle class is. The ones that hold themselves as black leaders are, in my opinion, incompetent. I don't challenge their heart. I challenge their head. I believe that Jesse Jackson, Maxine Waters, who justified the L.A. riots by saying no justice, no peace, Maxine Waters, who refers to the Republican Party as the enemy, Maxine Waters, who once wrote a letter to Fidel Castro urging him not to extradite a former Black Panther who shot and killed a New Jersey trooper and escaped from prison about 30 years ago and fled to Cuba. She wrote Castro a letter urging him not to extradite her and referring to her as a freedom fighter and likening her to Martin Luther King Jr. This is what passes for, quote, black leadership today, close quote, and frankly, it is quite pathetic. I have, by the way, tried to get all these people on my show. The one time I had a, you really can't even call it a debate. I was on a program with Jesse Jackson, and the issue was, several years ago, was whether or not blacks had attained their fundamental civil rights. And I went first, and I said, yes, black people have attained their fundamental civil rights. Jackson then began talking about the gap between the rich and the poor. And I said, well, Reverend Jackson, I thought this conversation was about civil rights, not about wealth. You want to have a conversation about what causes wealth, we can have that, but I thought we were here to talk about civil rights. To which Jackson responded, well, obviously Mr. Elder identifies with the white man. Turn back here.
When I was first training up as a police officer, which I've retired from now, we used to make fun of the perverted little Mayberries for the justice of the peace, and the sheriff would get a piece of the action on every speeding ticket. And we used to be pretty hard on people who would shoot to kill somebody fleeing for a nonviolent offense. And yet I see in our drug war, there have been, 30-some shoot-downs, including the murder of a missionary and her kid. We see asset forfeiture going mad, and police lining their pockets with what they can take from the suspect. And I'm getting mighty tired of law enforcement being corrupted from what was a decent profession into a nest of thieves and blue noses.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a question?
Well,
I'd like to comment on it.
Well, that is one of the many reasons, of course, to call off the war on drugs. The temptation for corruption, although I believe most officers are honest officers, the temptation certainly is there. You left out one other thing, the use of informants. How do you bust people without using informants? And, of course, the informant has every reason to give you a give up somebody, whether or not that person, in fact, is dirty, is sometimes beside the point. So the growing use of informants, the growing use of electronic wiretapping, the growing use of asset forfeitures, these are perfectly legitimate reasons on their own for us to reconsider the war on drugs. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Can you hear me all right? My question is this. As a black conservative, I look around and see that essentially everyone in the country at some level is getting used to bread and circuses, to put it plainly. And there seems to be a lot more of them than there are of us. I mean, we can look in this room right here. We had to hold this after work because we were all working. We're not out waiting for somebody to give us a handout. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wonder, or my question is, really, how practical is it that we're actually going to affect change? Because there's just so many more of them with their hands out. They're used to getting their hands, you know, filled up. And, I mean, what are we going to do about it in the long run, I guess?
Well, again, I am not at all pessimistic. I think things are getting better. I think they will get better. Look, we have a very large growing black middle class. We have a Secretary of State who is black. We have a National Security Advisor who is black. We have lots of elected officials in the South who have been elected in majority white cities. When Jesse Jackson stood up and commented on a Supreme Court decision striking down race-based districts, he and others were yelling and screaming about the Southern blacks who now had to run in majority white districts. Well, what happened? Every single one of those that decided to run for re-election, every single one got re-elected. And the very same people who were yelling and screaming about how bigoted white people were in the South and who would never vote for them didn't say one word. The situation is this. You and others like you are the ones who are out there every single day making it happen. There are two black Americas. There's yours and mine, and then there's so-called the underclass black America. That's the one that I'm concerned about. Middle-class blacks who often talk about racism, look, they can fend for themselves. It's the underclass, 30% of blacks, that I'm worried about. Those are the ones. 89% of black teens, according to a CNN Time poll, said they found little or no racism in their own lives. Black kids, white kids, Asian kids, Hispanic kids pretty much watch the same television. Black young kids are less likely to self-identify as Democrats. So I'm seeing a change here, and I'm seeing a change where a lot of young people are rejecting affirmative action. A lot of them feel that there's a stigma there, and that they don't want to have anything at all to do with it. And I see a world where more and more people are beginning to criticize some of these what I call victocrats and the victocrat mentality. I mean, the very fact that my book did so well, that I have the number one rated show in Los Angeles, that others are beginning to speak out. John McWhorter is standing over here. He wrote a book called Losing the Race. John, you want to stand up? And it was a brilliant, brilliant book, and it talked about the anti-education ethos that so many black people have and what to do about it. The book sold extremely well, and John has been speaking out and making the rounds. There's something going on that's causing people like John and people like myself to get invited to speak at places like this, and for C-SPAN to carry it. So I'm very optimistic, and I think that more and more people looking at some of the personal habits of some of our so-called black leaders are beginning to rethink their assumptions as well. So I'm very optimistic about the future. Yes, ma'am.
Would you clarify your view on, in regard to Clinton and Condit, with a libertarian support of personal rights? Is it the lie or the acts or a combination?
Hmm. Well, I can only speak about from my own perspective. I don't know that there's a libertarian point of view about either one of these things. My own opinion about Bill Clinton, I mean, you know, aside from the fact that he's a statist and a collectivist, and the way most Democrats are, and unfortunately the way many Republicans are, aside from that, I found him a charming, charming, devious person. And I felt that when you, as the number one legal authority in the country, as commander-in-chief, when you lie under oath in a lawsuit that was launched by a private citizen, when you attempt to get others to lie under oath, when you suborn perjury, that's it. End of statement. That's a high crime and misdemeanor, and he should have been thrown out of office. Even Robert Byrd. Isn't it interesting? Robert Byrd was called the conscience of the Senate until the impeachment. And we began speaking out against Clinton. Suddenly he wasn't the conscience of the Senate anymore. He spoke harshly about the president, said that he had committed a high crime and misdemeanor, but voted not to convict because he felt that the people in his district didn't want him to leave office. But I thought he should have left. I mean, the rule of law is very important. You simply can't have somebody lie under oath. There are people who have gone to jail who have lied under oath about sexual matters. Barbara Badalino had to go to jail. She lied under oath about a sexual matter. I had her on my show. There are people who are behind bars who've done exactly the same thing the president did, and he got a pass, and it's wrong. And as far as Condon is concerned, it's not about his personal life. His constituents will deal with him on that. It's about when somebody is missing, and the police come to you, and they ask you about that person, and you lie to them once, you lie to them twice, you lie to her family. You try to get somebody to sign a false affidavit. You hire a PR person to trash the character of the person who's missing and who may be murdered. That's enough. It's enough. Yes, sir.
Give sort of an overview of the assault on your program and lessons learned kind of thing.
Okay. I've been on the air for maybe a couple of years, getting all sorts of very nasty letters, and I started getting calls from our marketing department telling me that clients are beginning to leave my show. And I'm not supposed to name them by name, but if you heard my show, you can tell they're not there anymore. This is about 5 years ago. And one after another began to pull, and we found out that a group called the Talking Drum Community Forum was sending letters to all of my clients, and they were receiving hundreds of letters from people who were very concerned about this racist talk show host in Los Angeles named Larry Elder. And there was a flyer with my picture on it, and it says, here are some of the things that Larry Elder has said. It's okay for white people to call black people niggers. Blacks cause all crime in America. I mean, I work for Disney. Can you imagine if I ever said anything so idiotic? I would be fired by the first commercial break. Nevertheless, these clients, some of them were airline companies, some of them were food companies, some of them were consumer products companies. Nevertheless, they got these letters and they made some calls and they said, I don't know who he is. I don't know what he is. All I know is a bunch of black people are upset. And, of course, the idea is not to get caught between the dog and the hydrant. $5 million in lost advertising revenue. The station came to me and they said, look, we can't make any money now off your show. We're going to have to cut your show in half. They did. They cut my show in half. I was on from 3 until 7, and from that point on, I was on from 3 until 5 for 91 days. And the Eldorados, as I call them, wrote and stomped and picketed, gathered around the station, lobbied for me to come back, and after 91 days, I was back. We found out that the Talking Drum Community Forum consisted of maybe 20 people. And we found that out because we decided to write to all these people and have them come in and have a session sort of like this one, meet Larry, talk to Larry, find out I don't have horns and a tail, and who knows? Maybe they'll stop doing this. So we sent letters, and we kept getting back. No address, no address, no address. They're all phony. Some guy had a handful of people generating a bunch of letters, giving people the impression that there were hundreds, if not thousands, of people who hated Larry Elder. The interesting thing is, corporate America didn't care. Nobody picked up the phone and did any investigation. They didn't care. That's why you have a Jesse Jackson mau-mauing Toyota and having them kowtow and sign this multi-billion dollar deal. Racism is bad for business. And that's why it's so ludicrous to act as if racism is the number one problem in America, for crying out loud. Marge Schott is the former owner of the Cincinnati Reds. Used to collect Nazi memorabilia, okay? Iron crosses, stuff like that. Look at her lineup when she was running the team. Jose Rijo, Deion Sanders, Reggie Sanders, Dave Parker. Not because she wanted them to come in for tea. She had to win. And she couldn't win without black and Latin talent. Come on. Ted Stepien was the former owner of the Cleveland Cavaliers. He decided to buy the team. This is in the 70s and late 70s. And he publicly said, the reason the team is not doing well from a commercial standpoint is that there are too many black players. When I buy this team, I'm going to put more white players on the floor. Honestly, he said that. And bought the team and did just that. You ever heard of Mike Bratz? Point guard. The team was worse than it was before. It had less fan support than before. Surprise, surprise, Ted Stepien found out the white people don't want to watch white people lose any more than they want to watch black people lose. One more question? Yes, sir.
The mic is on its way. You have referred to several positive changes in our youth. I appreciate that. I am a pastor. How can we as a society, but especially churches, encourage those positive changes in our youth?
I've been very disappointed with some of the clergy in Los Angeles, with the refusal to emphasize personal responsibility. And that's what we're talking about. Personal responsibility and accountability. The problems most people face are problems of their own making. And the good news is they can be solved with effort and with hard work and with hope. I do a lot of speaking before young people, and I'm asked the same question over and over again, what can I do? And the answer is to think of yourself as an individual. Don't think of yourself as a victim. Don't think of yourself with what I call the victocrat mentality. Stand on your own two feet. Work hard, be honest, be trustworthy, and you'll live a fine life. Find people who share your values. Get a job, any job, keep that job. Do not quit that job until you get another job, and you will not be poor. If you decide to get married, try and marry somebody who shares your values. Try to stay together. If you decide to have kids, try to stay together. My mother and my father have been married 53 years. Hasn't always been good. They stuck it out, and they were a positive model for me. And I hope, if I ever have children, to be a positive model for mine. I think that's it. Thank you.
I want to especially thank Larry Elder for his work. He's a courageous figure. Obviously, he stirs people up, and that's exactly what we think our society needs more of, is a discussion of issues in a way that hopefully gets us closer to understanding them. Copies of his book are available upstairs for those of you who don't have a copy, and for those of you who do, he'd be delighted to continue autographing. I also want to thank all of you for joining with us and making our program so successful. I also want to thank all of our C-SPAN viewers for joining with us. We look forward to your joining with us at our next event. Thank you for coming. Good night.